Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson. This week on Talk Nation Radio, we'll be speaking with Alice Slater, an expert on nuclear power, nuclear weapons, and nuclear war. But first, my own thoughts on what the 4th of July celebrates. It's just possible that the space of 236 years and a truckload of fireworks are obscuring our vision. It's hard for us to see what should be obvious. Many nations, including Canada as the nearest example to the United States, have gained their independence without wars. We claim that a war was for independence and was therefore good, but if we could have had all the same advantages without the war, would that not have been even better? Back in 1986, a book was published by now Virginia State Delegate and Minority Leader David Toscano, the great nonviolent strategist Gene Sharp, and others, called Resistance, Politics, and the American Struggle for Independence, 1765 to 1775. Those dates are not a typo. During those years, the people of the British colonies that would become the United States used boycotts, rallies, marches, theatrics, non-compliance, bans on imports and exports, parallel extra-legal governments, the lobbying of Parliament, the physical shutting down of courts and offices and ports, the destruction of tax stamps, endless educating and organizing, and the dumping of tea into a harbor. All to successfully achieve a large measure of independence, among other things, prior to the war for independence. Homespinning clothes to resist the British Empire was practiced in the future United States long before Gandhi tried it. The colonists didn't talk about their activities in Gandhian terms. They didn't forswear violence. They sometimes threatened it and occasionally used it. They also, disturbingly, talked of resisting slavery to England, even while maintaining actual slavery. And they spoke of their loyalty to the king, even while denouncing his laws. Yet they largely rejected violence as counterproductive. They repealed the Stamp Act after effectively nullifying it. They repealed nearly all of the Townshend Acts. The committees they organized to enforce boycotts of British goods also enforced public safety and developed a new national unity. And then they chose to turn to violence, a choice that need not be excused, much less glorified. We've moved beyond many common practices of the 18th century. Why not that one as well? While we imagine that the Iraq War was the only one started with lies, we forget that the Boston Massacre was distorted beyond recognition, including in an engraving by Paul Revere that depicted the British as butchers. We erase the fact that Benjamin Franklin produced a fake issue of the Boston Independent in which the British boasted of scalp hunting. And we forget the elite nature of the opposition to Britain. We drop down the memory hole the reality of those early days for ordinary, nameless people. Howard Zinn explains, quote, "Around 1776, certain important people in the English colonies made a discovery that would prove enormously useful for the next 200 years. They found that by creating a nation, a symbol, a legal unity called the United States, they could take over land, profits, and political power from favorites of the British Empire. In the process, they could hold back a number of potential rebellions and create a consensus of popular support for the rule of a new, privileged leadership." End quote. In fact, prior to the violent revolution, there had been 18 uprisings against colonial governments, 6 black rebellions, and 40 riots. The political elites saw a possibility for redirecting anger toward England. The poor, who would not profit from the war or reap its political rewards, had to be compelled by force to fight in it. Many, including slaves, promised greater liberty by the British, deserted or switched sides. The Declaration of Independence was an indictment of King George III for various abuses of power. And those abuses of power look fairly similar to abuses of power we happily permit U.S. presidents to engage in today, either as regards the people of the United States or the people of territories and nations that our military occupies today in a manner uncomfortably resembling Britain's rule over the 13 colonies. Imagine if King George had kept a secret list of the individuals he would murder without any due process. I am confident that outrage would have topped the list in the Declaration of Independence, but King George didn't do anything that outrageous. The war for independence was also a war to open up the West to expansion and wars against Native Americans. King George, according to the Declaration of Independence, had, quote, endeavored to bring on the inhabitants of our frontiers the merciless Indian savages, end quote. But those were people fighting in defense of their lands and lives, rather like the people of Afghanistan today. Interestingly, when the British surrendered at Yorktown and departed, the Americans didn't cry out, "Please don't abandon us." Do we really believe that Afghans have no love for independence? Are we completely unaware that we have become the Redcoats? Or are we beginning to be able to see? I'm thrilled to have as a guest today on Talk Nation Radio, Alice Slater, New York director of the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation. She is a founder of Abolition 2000, a global network supporting the elimination of nuclear weapons and nuclear power. Ms. Slater is on the board of the Lawyers Committee for Nuclear Policy, the Steering Committee of Shutdown Indian Point, and the Energy Committee of the New York City Bar Association. She is a member of the Anti-War and Environmental Solidarity Working Groups at Occupy Wall Street. She serves on the advisory boards of the Rideau Institute and the Global Network Against Weapons in Space. Ms. Slater is a UN NGO representative and has written numerous articles and op-eds with frequent appearances on local and national media. You can learn more at spaceforpeace.org and abolition2000.org. Alice Slater, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
I'm delighted to be here.
We are planning to make this show available on the 4th of July, the day of the Declaration of Independence, which, of course, was a long list of grievances against then-King George III. But we didn't have nuclear weapons then. We didn't, as far as I know, have a kill list to complain about. There have been changes, technological and otherwise. I wonder what is your reading on this holiday of where we stand in terms of restraining tyrannical power? Have we made progress? Have we lost ground? Has a holiday designed around resistance to tyranny become a celebration of tyranny in some ways?
Well, I think you're putting it very well. I've been in a state of shock since I've been learning about our president's drone warfare. I mean, he's bombing eight countries. He has been bombing eight countries with these drones. He's gone much further than Bush and Cheney went. I mean, we were in Afghanistan, Iraq, Pakistan, Uganda, Somalia, Yemen. I mean, and he's in a room with three men. The New York Times had a big expose on how these decisions are made. I mean, the CIA director and the National Security Advisor, and the three of them are picking out who they're going to assassinate. And that included American citizens, and without the president is acting as judge, jury, and executioner, all in one person. In a way, it's kind of sad because I don't think we'd be giving Bush and Cheney a free ride on this, but people think, you know, Obama is one of the good guys.
I couldn't agree more. I wonder on the issue of nuclear power and nuclear weapons, whether that isn't one of the areas where some people claim actual progress rather than making Bush and Cheney's crimes even worse without the criticism.
I am discouraged by Obama's direction. I mean, despite the stirring words that he used in his Prague speech about looking at a nuclear weapons-free world, looking forward to that, he added the qualifier, "It might not happen in my lifetime." And then Hillary Clinton was very interesting. She misquoted the president, his Secretary of State, saying, as President Obama said, "We want a nuclear weapons-free world, but it might not happen for several lifetimes." And at the rate he's going, it's never going to happen, because he actually signed off on this small little treaty with Russia, the START treaty, which we hadn't had any agreement with them for years. And we cut our massive nuclear arsenal somewhat to like 1,500 each live ready to fire on notice immediately nuclear bombs, you know, many times greater than the power of the Hiroshima and Nagasaki bombs. And in exchange for that, he gave away the store. He promised the Congress he would spend $104 billion on new nuclear weapons, including three new bomb factories at Los Alamos to build the plutonium cores of the nuclear weapons at Oak Ridge, Tennessee, where they're building a new tritium factory, which is the booster. Tritium is the radioactive booster that gives the bomb more bang for the buck. And a whole new weapons facility in Kansas City, Kansas, to build the mechanical parts of the bomb. So there's three new bomb factories, $84 billion for the weapons, and then he promised another $100 billion for new delivery systems. That's missiles, submarines, and aircraft carriers to carry nuclear weapons. So this was like, I really think Obama, when I think about it, is like the Manchurian candidate. I mean, they put him in there. We all went for him. Everybody was sick of Bush and Cheney and their warlike policies. And we wound up with a kinder, gentler face, and we're getting the same awful policies. I mean, we're surrounding Russia with missiles. We had a treaty with Russia, the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty, where Russia and the United States promised not to build anti-missile systems in order to be able to ratchet down the nuclear arms race, because this way we wouldn't need so many weapons to overcome the anti-weapon missile. So we had this treaty, it was called the ABM Treaty. Clinton started to erode it by building bases in Alaska for new missiles, and Bush just walked out of it. And now we're actually putting missile bases in former Soviet republics and the former parts of Eastern Europe, and this has totally ratcheted up the arms race with Russia so that there's no hope. And as far as the nuclear weapons go, it's strictly up to us and Russia, because there are like 22,000 nuclear bombs on the planet, and 21,000 of them are in the U.S. and Russia. So the other 1,000 nuclear weapons altogether are in all the other countries, which there are 9 right now. That's China, France, England, India, Pakistan, Israel, and North Korea. So they have between them 1,000. So if the U.S. and Russia don't get serious about cutting our arsenals, nobody else will come to the table to talk about this dream that he expressed about nuclear weapons. And that's why it's not going to be in his lifetime at the rate he's going. And we're also antagonizing China. And what very few people know is that Russia and China for the past 8 years have been proposing a treaty to keep weapons out of space at the UN in Geneva, where the Commission on Disarmament, where they negotiate disarmament treaties. Every country in the world votes for it except the United States of America. That is because we are totally in the grip of this military, industrial, congressional, academic complex.
Alice Slater is the New York director of the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation and a founder of Abolition 2000. Alice, I'm curious, as you talk about Russia and a new arms race, whether it's not perhaps even worse than a new arms race. In May, we begin to hear comments from top military officials and the prime minister in Russia about the possibility of a preemptive strike against one of these so-called missile defense bases being put near Russia's borders, and the possibility of nuclear war. We're also hearing suggestions that Russia might step in and defend Iran should Iran be attacked by the United States or Israel or the West. Am I right in thinking that we hadn't heard this kind of talk between the United States and Russia for a lot of years, or had I just missed it?
Absolutely. And, you know, Russia, really, I think they've been the kind of gentler nation. I mean, when the Berlin Wall fell, I think Gorbachev was like a saint. It fell without a shot. He let all of Eastern Europe go free without exacting any price. And the only thing he asked us is that we shouldn't have a unified Germany in NATO, because they lost 20 million people during World War II to the German onslaught and invasion of Russia. And we promised him that we would take a unified Germany into NATO, but that we would not expand NATO one more inch. that was the promise, that we allowed them to not make a fuss about this. And now we're, not only did we take all of Eastern Europe into NATO, but we're actually talking about putting missiles in Georgia. These are former Soviet republics. They were on their territory. It's like if the Russians were doing it in Mexico, or like they did it in Cuba, and we didn't tolerate it. You know, we made them get out. Reagan and Gorbachev actually had a discussion about going to zero nuclear weapons, and Gorbachev was willing if Reagan would give up Star Wars, and Reagan said he would not give up Star Wars. And that is the grip of these military contractors. The irony is that these anti-missiles don't even work. I mean, they can be so easily overcome by decoys. I mean, if you, to try to keep a nuclear weapon from attacking the United States, there's no way that an anti-missile could guarantee that an onslaught of incoming weapons and decoys, that we could guarantee that we would hit the one missile that's carrying the bomb. And even all their tests are rigged. I mean, they put radar on the target so that they can find it. It doesn't really work, which is the other irony. And here we are shoving it under Russia's nose. I don't think we're going to have nuclear war. I think we're just going to have this, you know, really hostile environment until Americans wise up. China and Russia, I think, would be very happy to give up missiles and space weapons and nuclear. China's on record that they'll give up nuclear weapons if the U.S. and Russia get their act together. And Russia doesn't want to go further on talking about cuts because of our provocative missile time. It's just like, I think we're very, you know, we're still the Wild West. We're very naive. We started the nuclear arms race. When we got the bomb, Stalin asked us to put it under UN authority, and we could have had, and we said no, we kept it. We were going to be the only ones. Well, that's insane. That's like a baby sticking their head under a cover and thinking nobody can see them because they're hiding. I mean, Russia went and got the bomb. I think what we're doing now with the drone is insane, because this is not a nuclear weapon. Any computer savvy nerd can make a drone, and I think we're in for it here on our own territory, that we are the first ones to go out and use these things. Just like the nuclear weapon, we're setting a precedent for other countries to use them, and it's going to be much easier for them. And the other thing we're doing is this cyber warfare. We're boasting that we shut down Iran's uranium enrichment, which, by the way, they are perfectly legally entitled to do. They're entitled to enrich uranium under the Non-Proliferation Treaty, where all the countries in the world except five nuclear weapon states promise not to get nuclear weapons, and in turn we promise them everything, the whole menu of so-called peaceful nuclear technology. I mean, that's another insanity, because we're giving everybody the keys to the bomb factory by giving them this peaceful nuclear technology. They can make a bomb, and then we're saying, but don't you use it. And then there are some people that we don't even reprimand. I mean, Brazil is enriching uranium. Japan is enriching uranium. We don't talk to them. But Iran, we threaten. If you enrich uranium, we're going to know all the options are on the table. Now we're actually doing cyber warfare and admitting it and cutting down their factories, which makes us so vulnerable. We in the United States are so dependent on our computers operating safely without invasion. And here, we were the first. Just like we were the first to use the bomb and the first to use drones, we are now the first to do this cyber warfare. And I think this government is putting us in danger. Our national security is at risk from these dopey, provocative, aggressive, Wild West policies where they actually think they can maintain an advantage.
I was very interested in your remark about the extent to which virtually all the nuclear weapons are in the hands of the United States and Russia. But I wonder if you could tell our listeners physically where the United States nuclear weapons are, because I assume they're not all in the territory of the United States.
We have a NATO nuclear sharing policy where we have about 600 weapons in five European countries. NATO countries, Spain, Italy, Germany, Turkey, and the Netherlands, have our nuclear weapons stationed on their property in NATO. The rest of them are in submarines plying the oceans 24/7 or poised on missiles. We have missile bases. They're all on in our property, on in the United States territory. There are 1,500 after the START treaty that are prepped and ready to go, and those are on submarines, on missiles, on land-based missiles, and they're in airplanes that are parked. Now, this is another insanity of our country. We used to have the bombs in the air 24/7, and at the point where we ended nuclear testing in the atmosphere, when it went underground, then we had the moratorium on underground tests. I have a copy of the congressional record that said that from the time, like from 1956 until 88, when they did the nuclear testing moratorium underground, because Russia did one, so we answered them, there were 38 airplane accidents carrying nuclear bombs where they crashed. And except for two that spewed a little plutonium in Palomary, Spain, and Thule, Greenland, none of them ever went off. So they were arguing they had to keep testing for the safety and reliability of the arsenal, but we were saying, look how safe and reliable they are. They crashed in these airplanes, and they never went off. I think there are a couple of them still under water off the coast of Georgia. This was an insane system to keep airplanes flying all the time, and there was a general in the 90s, General Lee Butler, that took over Strategic Air Command, and he grounded all the planes and said he was not going to have them flying. They call it the nuclear triad, land, air, and sea. And now that the budget is so under stress, there are some sensible old warriors, you know, it's always after they leave the Army, that are saying that at least we should cut one of the triads or maybe just keep our nukes on submarines as a way to make further cuts. And the ones that are on missiles are on hair trigger alert. They're ready to fire in 15 minutes. Like in the 80s, a Norwegian weather satellite went off course. And in the Soviet Union, there are guys that are supposed to launch all the missiles against us if they see an incoming missile. The man, this Colonel Petrov that was on duty, they all said there's a missile coming at us. And he decided to disobey orders. He didn't launch an attack against us, what would be a counterattack, and it turned out it was a weather satellite that was off course from Norway. I mean, this is how close we've come. We've just been totally lucky.
This is why I wonder, Alice Slater of Abolition2000.org, I wonder whether the question of whether we get into a nuclear war comes down to the United States and Russia, just because these two nations have most of the nuclear weapons. Because it seems to me that as the technology proliferates, the nuclear energy technology and the nuclear weapons technology and possession of bombs proliferates to more countries, even though in smaller quantities, the possibility for accidents and misunderstandings and mishaps, as well as for further proliferation, seems to grow exponentially.
I can't really put your mind at ease except to say that you know, we have to be very clear. We have to phase out nuclear power, because at the point where they were getting nervous about Iran and about other countries' nuclear power, that they could make weapons, after all, India and Pakistan and Israel, they were outside of the treaty, and they got nuclear weapons through their nuclear power. And North Korea was a member of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. They got the technology for peaceful nuclear technology. They walked out of the treaty and made bombs. So as they got more nervous, you heard more and more of them talking in this very 20th century patriarchal, hierarchical system that we're going to control the nuclear fuel cycle. Only certain countries will be able to enrich it, and we'll have like an international enrichment center. In other words, in order to get the, they take the uranium and they enrich it a certain degree, which you put in a nuclear reactor to make nuclear power. But then if you put it through the enrichment process a few more times, it's good enough for a bomb. So the hardest thing is to build a reactor that can make this first round of plutonium. Once you've got a peaceful nuclear reactor, you're in business. Being that the next level of enrichment is something you can do easily, you can hide it. Oh, but once they said we're going to control it, there were like 23 new countries that said they were going to get nuclear power that never had them before, including Jordan, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Vietnam, Malaysia, Bangladesh. I mean, all these countries that didn't want to go near nuclear power, they're all trying to get in under the wire. And then you have these commercial interests trying to sell it to them. Now, there's been really good news, like Germany has walked out of nuclear power, and Siemens company that made the reactors, they're going out of business. They're not going to sell them. Jordan is there. Their parliament just passed a law that they don't want it. There were 3,000 Bedouins that demonstrated in Egypt this week to say they don't want Egypt to build new nuclear power. I mean, there's been people walking back from it. Burma walked away from it. The new government there, they were going to get it, and they said no. The bad news is that if Russia and the U.S. don't, if we don't stop pushing on missiles and being like the bully on the block, expanding NATO, then Russia's going to rearm and and be in a more hostile posture to us. Up till now, they were kind of, we treated Russia terribly. When the wall came down, we should have come in like with a Marshall Plan to help them, convert their economy. Instead, we just, all our robber barons went in and grabbed all their resources, and their life expectancy went down. I mean, the people did so badly after the fall of communism because they had no transition and they had no help. Now they're getting their act together. They have enough money now to spend again on armaments. And Putin is, very adamant. If we keep being aggressive, they'll be aggressive back. I think the chance of nuclear war is much more accidental than deliberate. I think deliberately, I don't think anybody would really dare to do it deliberately. I think people are too aware of what nuclear war, it could actually destroy the whole planet. They talk about nuclear winter, now they're talking about nuclear famine, crops wouldn't grow. The thing to be afraid of is like an accident. We should get them off this notice to fire, hair trigger alert, that we could do immediately. And then we must change our system of government. We can't allow this military, industrial, academic, congressional complex drive this whole system. The thing is we have allies because it's not just the military, it's like the corporate system, that's willing to do GMO foods and mountaintop removal and nuclear power, all these horrible things that they want to inflict on us and the tar sands. I think we have more and more allies that we're fighting the same system. And if we can be clever about that and at least let people understand that the military is part of the system we have to fight, I think we have a good chance. Our planet needs us, there's a new consciousness coming. I mean, it wasn't until 1968 that we actually saw the Earth from the moon, that beautiful picture of the Earth, this blue orb floating on a sea of black velvet. And that consciousness that we're one world, that we're all together, that we have to pull together is just, it's only 40, 50 years old in the grand scheme of things. And we're now at a crossroads where we have to shift the paradigm and care about the planet.
That is a beautiful place on which to leave it. We have been speaking with Alice Slater, who is the New York director of the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation and a founder of Abolition 2000. Alice, thanks for being on Talk Nation Radio.
Well, thank you.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, engineered by Christiane Brown in Reno, Nevada, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. Until next time.